I'm Pete Havel. I'm the author of a book called The Arsonist in the Office, Fireproofing Your Life Against Toxic Coworkers, Bosses, Employees, and Cultures. And I'm going to teach you some tips on ways to protect yourself in the workplace. I'm excited to be on today on race.
Violence. And medicine. Go ahead, do it.
Oh, you want me to do that again?
No, keep going. Race, violence, and medicine. Just say it.
Race, violence, and medicine.
Welcome to Race, Violence, and Medicine. I am Dr. Brian H. Williams, and I have a question for you. Have you ever worked with an arsonist? An arsonist is that toxic employee that burns down careers, cultures, and organizations for either fun, revenge, personal agendas, or ego, or spite. If you can relate to that, you will enjoy our next guest. This is Pete Havel, author of the book, The Arsonist in the Office, Fireproofing Your Life Against Toxic Coworkers, Bosses, Employees, and Cultures. Pete, welcome to Race, Violence, and Medicine.
Brian, thanks for having me.
Well, I got to say, Pete, I thoroughly enjoyed reading your book. And I tell you, I read a lot of nonfiction. I'm always trying to educate myself. And some books I will force myself to get through because the information is important to me. But your book was a fun read from beginning to end, and I learned a lot. And scarily, I saw a lot of myself in some of the anecdotes that you put in the book.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
You know, you mentioned it's funny, and I hear constantly, and we'll obviously talk more about the book and the subject matter of dealing with toxic people, but when you write a book about the worst moment in your life, you're sitting there thinking, I want to tell this story, but nobody wants to hear some guy whining about what happened to him. So I really had to turn it into a topic that was fun to read, and there was a bit of a trick to that. Because you had to, nobody could get through a couple hundred pages of misery. You had to make my ride over the cliff in the craziest workplace ever something enjoyable.
Right.
So it sounds like I hit the target.
Well, at least with me. But for my listeners, why don't you give us a little bit of your background?
Sure. I've spent most of my career in politics. I've been a lobbyist for much of my life, and I probably alienated most of your listeners just with those words. Not too many people are that excited about hearing from a lobbyist on anything, but spent a lot of time in politics just fighting for businesses, small business owners, that type of thing. And it's not an easy business. A lot of loud voices in the political process. And I had thought going into the job that I talk about in the book, that I could handle just about anything. I dealt with every situation you can imagine, every personality imaginable, but I had not dealt with the toxic culture.
So I guess from that experience as a lobbyist, that's what led to the impetus for you to write this book, The Arsonist in the Office?
That's right. I had a, after going through some phenomenal jobs, I got hired into a company that had really lost its way. And I got hired to work with the employee, and this is one side of a toxic workplace. I got hired to work with the employee that management was terrified of, that they were too afraid to fire because of how much bad behavior they had already inflicted upon the organization. They were scared of what the employee might do to them from the outside. And they brought me in to kind of water down the trouble that she was causing. And let's just say it did not go well for the author.
So tell us what that was like. Did you come in knowing that was your charge, or that you kind of showed up and all of a sudden, hey, we have this problem and you're it?
Oh no! Literally day two. I should say. Let me describe the first 3 days of work. Day one, I walk in the door and random people start coming up to me, offering condolences, offering prayer for me, saying and speculating about what my next job might be like after I get out of this job if it doesn't work out well. And I don't know what people, frankly, are talking about. I'm asking them, but they seem very nervous about saying anything to me other than kind of giving their disclaimers of, sorry you're here. Sorry. I guess sorry about what was about to happen to me. Day two, the CEO calls me in, and it sums it all up with his first words, which is, Pete, I should have told you all of this before you took the job, but I don't think you'd be here today. And he went on to describe exactly what my challenge was and pointed out all the many ways he had protected himself in the organization, within the organizational charts, had erased the lines of reporting, that he had assigned a manager lower in the ranks to deal with this problem employee, and that they were going to do the best they could with me and in this situation, but that I should be happy because they were paying me well and that I should consider it combat pay. How's that for the first 3 days on the job?
Yeah, I'm wondering, like, how does that make you feel?
I was both nervous but confident. And when I say that, and irrationally confident as it worked out, but my thought was, I know how to handle difficult people. I've done this before. But what I wasn't taking into account is if an organization is creating a free-for-all within their culture, you can deal with one problem, but it starts becoming difficult when you've got dozens of problems, or that the organization is, when they turn a blind eye to what one person is doing, four or five others around the company look around and say, hold my beer, let me see what I can get away with. It was pervasive in everything that was going on there within some corners of the organization. And frankly, it's not that different than a lot of parts of life, in that some people turn away. Some people are uncomfortable with having tough decisions. Some people are uncomfortable with making a decision, and a lot of people put self-preservation above leadership. And when that happens, you've got problems.
Right, right. So in your book, you dedicate a chapter to talking about how to recognize a toxic workplace. And you also have another chapter about how to fireproof your hiring process. Now, say you're the prospective employee that is interviewing at a place. You do not have that sort of inside information to determine that. What would you have done prior to you going to this job to maximize the amount of information you had to make an informed choice?
One of the first things I would have done is jump on websites like Glassdoor that offer employee and former employee reviews of companies. You get a lot of information on there, and certainly some of it is kind of wheels off because an aggrieved employee that didn't like the flavors of coffee that were offered. Maybe they had a bad experience, and so they're gonna burn the former employer with the review. But you tend to have a bunch of reviews from larger companies where you've got kind of a sweet spot in the middle where you're gonna see some common themes. And I know when I looked, I was just looking at a company the other day, and their reviews, there seemed to be a thread throughout talking about management not listening to employees. They talked about racial strife within the organization and that was a problem. They talked about a toxicity level, and it wasn't just one or two. It was dozens of people saying the same types of things. So that's definitely a clue. Going on LinkedIn and finding people that have worked in your prospective employer's company before, check it out. Contact those people. Ask them what they think. Some people are going to say nothing and say, oh, I've got a non-disclosure, I can't say a word. Well, that probably gives you a sign right there. but other people are going to be honest with you and tell you exactly what it's like there, good or bad. You ought to do it because there are some phenomenal employers out there, but there's some companies with terrible cultures that you need to watch out for, and you just don't want the experience.
Right. Okay, so now you are at this new job. You find yourself in this toxic workplace that is on fire. What are you doing? Walk me through this process, because at some point you decided to write a book about it. Okay.
I did.
So what's happening while you're there?
While I'm there, and I go from chapter to chapter on this, providing people both a trip behind enemy lines with me, as well as practical information that they need. So it kind of varies one after the other, after the other, after the other, with that type of flow. One chapter involves me scheduling business meetings, and my colleague, the one that they described as the arsonist, they literally called her that. She was showing up at my meetings out of the office. Not invited, I was having my calendar monitored or something. Something was taking place where it was happening repeatedly. And I went to my supervisor and said, "Do you find this a little odd?" And my supervisor, who had dealt with this problem employee before, is waving it off and saying, "Everything's normal here. No, she just wants to partner with you." And I'm thinking, okay, well, that's a little bit strange. I have situations where we are working together on a project, and I find that I'm about to be hit with a barrage of accusations of all sorts of HR violations for having said to an employee, if I took five of the requirements to do a project, could they take the other five? And I found out that I was being threatened with a non-existent charge in the HR categories, but my manager there is sitting better him than me. It followed again and again and again. It escalated, and I won't go into it too much on here, but it escalated to a point where I was dealing with some rather disturbing behavior and an incident that I describe as it was a time when I didn't know if I needed a meeting with HR or whether I needed a restraining order from a colleague. It was a strange time. And what was consistent through all of that was leadership saying again and again, "Everything's fine here. Up is down, right is wrong. The moon is green."
It reminds me of Catch 22. That book. Have you read Catch 22?
I have.
Describe just what you're saying. Like, what you see with your own eyes and hear with your own ears is wrong.
That's the exact opposite. It was almost Orwellian in nature. But the thing, and I struggled with this in the book because I'm writing about a serious topic in my life of being with precisely the wrong organization and just corrupted values. But you're dealing with, and I would say this publicly, and I hope they're listening, of course, you're dealing with people that on many levels are probably fine individuals. But put them in a group in a bizarre setting, and you've got some just horrific decision making taking place that is motivated by, finances of, gosh, I've only got two more years to go until I get my full retirement, or this person's come after me, and I'll use this employee as cannon fodder at a put these two at arm's length between me and this problem employee. And it is both disappointing behavior, but it's also very human. And so when I was writing this, certainly they were not behaving in ways that leaders should, but people are infallible. They behaved irrationally, but it's not something we don't see in a lot of cases involving a lot of problems around the world.
Well,
but people need to watch out for it because their career could be blown up very quickly as mine was.
Well, is the arsonist always someone with nefarious intent? Because maybe they don't recognize that they're the arsonist. Because as I'm reading some of the anecdotes, I'm thinking, you know, maybe I've done some of these things. Because it's the perception of the other person, right? And you can contribute to a negative culture because you don't fit in, not necessarily because you were trying to destroy it. So is it possible that some arsonists just don't recognize what they're doing?
Sure. And some of that destructive behavior, and I didn't go into the sabotage of client work and that type of thing that that was engaging, I probably should have. You've got some behavior that all of us have at some point. We're negative, or at some point, you know, we don't contribute to a project as a full team member. Maybe we kind of just gave half effort, or we're not. Yeah, we're just having a bad day, bad week, bad month. You name it. Some of this behavior, especially around sabotage of work, I didn't get into some of these in the examples I mentioned, but, you know, undercutting of, the productivity of others, retaliation, and I have this as one of the biggest, boldest signs of a toxic workplace. If you speak up about a concern, will you disappear? And in some cultures, that is prevalent. It happens, and you have obviously that takes somebody who's in at a higher level of a company, but that is atrocious. It's damaging to everything an organization does because it silences not only debate, but it puts a fear level within organizations that is really destructive. And, you know, in your business, for instance.
It's not like they always get rid of you. It's sometimes it's just they make it so you don't want to stay, right? And you
absolutely.
Go away on your own accord.
That's right. It's the, you know, we wrote up a resignation letter for you. It's up to you to sign it as we stand here and you have about 30 seconds. There's certainly the freezing out that can take place, or, you know, you find out at that next time when you're up for a promotion or something like that they're staring daggers at you, and you get the message soon enough that your time there is about to end. So, yeah, it can play out in a bunch of different ways. But one of the things I talk about in the book is that self-awareness, like you just talked about, of what's happening here and thinking through it, because people don't know this stuff until they're in the middle of it. And that's not a good place to start learning some of these skills and perceptions.
So earlier you were talking about the role in HR and all of this. And in your book you said, HR is not your priest, your buddy, or your lawyer. Tell us more about the role of HR. I've talked to some people, and I think, I shouldn't say everybody, but a number of people are skeptical about the role of HR and going to them with issues, because many see them as representing the organization and not the interests of the person that is looking for recourse. What are your comments about that?
Well, I think that's very fair, and you'd probably have a lot of HR people that that would agree with it. They are in a tough spot when it comes to problems in the workplace, and especially if it's an individual's problems. And they are just as susceptible to office politics, just as susceptible to their jobs being harmed, and they are they're in a tough position because, yes, their primary role is not to support any individual. It's to support what the leadership tells them is to be their activity. They can choose to push back against it, but if an organization's leadership decides we want problems to go away, well, if you're perceived as the problem, you are, because you spoke up, you're not going to win that. And HR is, you know, their responsibility is to is to smooth the bump in the road. And sometimes you're going to get.
So you said this. Like, it doesn't matter how noble your cause or how right you are, or you know how well liked you are. You talked about that if leadership sees things one way and you see things why, in the end, you will lose.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I think for the most part, most HR professionals will say that on one level or another. And I don't say that as a negative. I just say that as a reality that they are part of the organization, but they're not referees. They're not going to say to the CEO, you know, stand down. We've got this. We're going to make the decisions here. It's the leadership at the top. Decides what the culture is, and at times, yeah, you can be right in every way, shape, and form, but you may be walked into that room off to the side that nobody knows what it's used for, but it's used for when employees are called in, handed a folder, and walked out of the office.
There are so many pearls in this book. I probably could have used this book, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago. But anyway, let's talk about toward the end, your job ended, which led to the impetus of the book. So talk to us about that transition and then getting to write the book.
Sure. So at the end, I referred to it just briefly, I went to my organization and they did what toxic organizations often do, which is let's get rid of the let's put some oil on the squeaky wheel and move me out. So that's what occurred to me at that point. And I found myself having gone from very confident in what I was doing to really being at a point that has been one of the most difficult periods of my life, but also one of the greatest opportunities. I found myself with a complete knowledge of a subject that most people never want to know anything about, and that is unemployment when you are faced with a story that you cannot tell in any interview. Somebody asks you why'd you leave your last employer, and I think you would agree, Brian, my exit was book-worthy. My experience was book-worthy. But that is
right.
Not a great ticket to finding your next job. So I had to figure out, you know, what my storyline is. How do you even talk about what you experience in your next interview? Or do you say nothing? And that's a problem too, when it sounds like you just walked out of your job like you change underwear. You just do it every day. You don't think much of it.
There's so much there. Either you're not being true to your own values and integrity. You look crazy, or you come across as being ungrateful and bad-mouthing where you came
That's
from.
That's right.
It just seems to be like no good options there.
there aren't. So that was a challenge. But at some point, and I, you know, my faith sustains me in good times and bad. I talk about the point where there's two sayings that I've used a lot in my life. One of them is God has a plan. And the other is, if it doesn't kill you, it makes you stronger. I firmly believe in both of those to a certain extent, but you don't want them at the same time playing out in your life. and what I've experienced over the last few years is really the attempt to turn adversity into opportunity. My career on some levels got blown up at that point, whether I knew it or not, in that in my field as a lobbyist, your relationships are huge to your job prospects. Anybody that sits out for any length of time is going to have more of a problem in getting that next job. And I face that, especially because of not having a story I can talk about. But as I talk to my friends, as I talk to people that I knew as business acquaintances, that type of thing, I realized some of the stuff I had experienced in that just absurd and corrupted culture was information about a subject that people are getting hit with every day in companies across the country. And it's frankly organizations that have weak leadership, bad or just amorphous values that change depending upon who the person is, what their status is within the company, bad behavior, whether it's the Me Too movement or I should say what was happening during Me Too and the Me Too movement that occurred from that. There's so much happening right now in the workplace, and every day in the business pages, you'll see something where you're like, I can't believe this person didn't learn the lessons from 2015, 2016, 2018, you name it. And I just saw an opportunity to share my story, help others that were in my position, which was somebody in management, but certainly not calling the shots, to help those people. I don't consider myself a victim in any way, but I was somebody that was hit hard by this. But I also look at the companies as somebody who's worked on behalf of management for years in my career and ownership of companies, saying, guys, you've got to get this together because you're embarrassing yourself when this is what you're leading. Let me show you how to have some simple, smart changes to how you deal with your organization, and you're going to keep out some problem people. You're going to deal with decisions better in the middle. And then if you need to make hard decisions about getting rid of folks, I'm going to give you a roadmap for what your standards might be, or think through these, decide if they match up with your values, and live those values every day. And it's really not rocket science. It's something that people live by as individuals every day, but so many organizations struggle with it. And I just decided I've got an opportunity here to be a voice and hopefully a bold, and I'm trying to be a courageous voice to step out and say, I've got some thoughts on how we can make things better. And if nobody else is going to jump out there, might as well be me.
Well, let's be fair, Pete. Your book is about transforming organizational toxicity. It's also about dealing with individuals who can be the epicenter of that toxicity. But at the core, this is a story about you and your resilience. And as you say in your last chapter, how you rose from the ashes. So you can't minimize how important your story is in this, and how that is an inspiration to others that will read this book. So thank you for sharing it in The Arsonist in the Office. And thank you for being on our show, Race, Violence, and Medicine.
It's been exciting. Thanks for this opportunity.
All right, y'all. This was Pete Habel, author of The Arsonist in the Office, Fireproofing Your Life Against Toxic Coworkers, Bosses, Employees, and Cultures. Pete, if our listeners want to contact you after the show, where can they reach you?
Sure. They can reach me through my website at petehavel.com, PETEHAVEL.com, and they can get my book through that website, or they can jump on Amazon to get it there as well. And I just finished up the audiobook version. So as you said, my book is fun, and hopefully the audiobook is fun as well, because we bring out all the crazy characters and the madness that I experienced in a form that almost feels like an old radio show.
Well, I guess I got to pause. I've been calling you Pete Habel, and it's Pete Habel. I've been mispronouncing your name, my friend, all this time. My bad. Thanks a lot for being on the show. And I want to thank you for tuning in. This is Dr. Brian H. Williams. You can check me out at my website, brianwilliamsmd.com. That's Brian with an I. And you can also follow me on Twitter at bhwilliamsmd. As always, I appreciate you for tuning into the show. If you could, I know you're listening, but maybe your family, friends, and colleagues do not know about Race, Violence, and Medicine, so let them know about the show. You can listen to it anywhere you get podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, on and on. We'll be bringing another show to you next week. Thanks for tuning in. Y'all have a good one.